The fact that I got denied, it seems like part of a much broader issue that there will just not be proper scrutiny of the consequences of this deal.
Welcome to Global Dispatches, a podcast for the foreign policy and global development communities and anyone who wants a deeper understanding of what is driving events in the world today. I'm your host, Mark Leon Goldberg. I am a veteran international affairs journalist and the editor of UN Dispatch. Enjoy the show. Looking for a trustworthy podcast to bring you unfiltered viewpoints and experiences on global health? Tune into Global Health Matters, the podcast that connects silos and amplifies diverse voices to give you a holistic picture. Each month, Dr. Gary Aslanian from the World Health Organization hosts discussions with guests spanning former ministers of health, award-winning journalists and authors, and frontline public health workers. Join listeners from across 180 countries for an exciting season 4, launching in June. Global Health Matters is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. The Parliament of the United Kingdom has passed a controversial new law that would enable the government to deport asylum seekers to Rwanda. Under the so-called Safety of Rwanda Bill, the Rishi Sunak government has pledged to send migrants in the UK to Rwanda, where their claims of asylum would be processed. But is Rwanda actually safe? My guest today, Sally Hayden, is a journalist who has reported extensively on migration and refugee issues. Last month, she was barred from Rwanda owing to her prior reporting on the plight of refugees who had been sent to Rwanda as part of a separate but similar European Union program. Sally Hayden is the author of My Fourth Time We Drowned, Seeking Refuge on the World's Deadliest Migration Route, which won the prestigious Orwell Prize. In our conversation, Sally Hayden discusses her prior reporting on refugees in Rwanda and helps put this new UK bill in the broader context of Europe's increasingly harsh policies towards refugees and asylum seekers. I last spoke with Sally Hayden a couple of years ago when her book came out. I recommend checking out that episode from the archives. And you can access that episode and our entire archive by going to globaldispatches.org. A subscription to Global Dispatches will unlock that whole archive and get you other bonus content as well, including essays that I write and commission from other experts in international affairs. Please visit globaldispatches.org and get your paying subscription to support our work. Thank you. Now here is my conversation with journalist Sally Hayden. Can you just kick off by explaining what happened when you last tried to enter Rwanda last month?
So I was flying to Rwanda on March 25th. I had boarded a flight in France the night before, and I was transiting through Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. My layover was like 6 hours, I think. And eventually I was lining up to board the final flight to Kigali and got to the front at the desk at the gate and slowly noticed that the airline staff were all looking at my passport and shaking their heads. And basically they explained to me that the Rwandan authorities had emailed them about 2 hours before and said that I'm specifically not allowed to board this flight. And so, you know, I was confused and I said, why? And they said, we don't have any reason. You need to take that up with the Rwandan authorities. So what happened at that point was they seized my passport. They told me that I can't stay in the airport. I have to book another flight somewhere else. And that's what I did. And that was that.
Just on like a logistical matter, like where did you end up buying a flight to?
I just came back to Beirut. I'm based out of Beirut at the moment.
So did you hear from Rwandan authorities about why your entry was denied?
Yeah, I mean, I tried to follow it up with many different people, and I was trying to figure out, was it a misunderstanding? I contacted even my embassy, who also tried to find out. I didn't really get clear answers. I had a accreditation application pending, so a lot of accreditation applications were kind of approved within a day or two, but some take longer. And I had ended up, I was like flying there without it approved, but that's not unusual. Like other journalists have done that since or had done that before. So I was also trying to follow up on my accreditation and see, will that still be approved? If that was approved, then I would have flown again or tried to fly again and seen if I could get in. But still, I haven't heard anything about that. It hasn't officially been denied. And I didn't really get clear answers on why I wasn't allowed to board the plane. You know, I asked someone from immigration and they said, oh, you're free to come. But they wouldn't give me an email or like an official document saying that I could definitely come, that I could show to the airline. And they wouldn't give me an explanation as to why I hadn't been allowed to come. And so it was very confusing. And I actually didn't say anything publicly about it for a few weeks because I was trying to get this resolved. But eventually I figured I should probably say it.
And what is your explanation for why it was that you were denied entry to Rwanda as a journalist last month?
I mean, my understanding or my assumption anyway would be that it's related to my previous reporting. So I've reported in Rwanda three times, 2014, 2019, and 2020. And the last two times were focused on the treatment of refugees, specifically who had been transferred to Rwanda through this kind of EU-backed scheme where refugees and asylum seekers are taken from Libya, go temporarily to Rwanda, and then they're transferred to other generally Western countries. And so the last time that I went to Rwanda, I ended up publishing a report about an allegation of attempted sexual assault by a kind of police person who was working in one of these camps against a minor refugee or asylum seeker boy. So I was contacted by refugees in the camp who said that they were really concerned that this had happened. There wasn't a proper investigation. The person who was accused was still kind of wandering freely around the camp. People were quite distressed about that. They had a list of demands that they felt would increase their safety, which included the presence of a UNHCR official on the camp and various other things. And so we published our report, but only after the Rwandan police force had gone public on Twitter and said that the boy was lying about the allegation. And after the report came out, the president's spokesperson posted online accusing me of writing refugee porn, and government-associated newspaper, The New Times, also repeated this allegation and said that I peddle lies. And so I was also like attacked a lot by pro-government Twitter trolls, if you want to call them that.
In that era, at least, there were a lot of those kind of pro-Rwanda, pro-Kagame Twitter trolls that would attack anyone who said anything untoward about Kagame. So it's kind of worth putting that into context.
Just to be clear, so that was in 2020, and I ended up like writing a chapter of my book, My Fourth Time We Drowned, focuses more generally on this scheme. It also mentions what happened in that case, and that chapter of the book and like my general reporting was used in the legal challenge against the UK deportation deal against the Home Office. That's the context of me being denied boarding on the plane. Again, I haven't been told exactly why I was denied boarding. And I didn't expect it. Like, it's not that I actually expected this to happen at all. I was wondering about my accreditation, like whether I'd have issues around that. But I didn't expect to be completely denied boarding. And that seems to be quite unusual.
Yeah. And like the broader context, the timing, I think, is important here. I mean, this, your denial of entry into Rwanda happened around the same time that the UK government was hotly debating, discussing this Rwanda bill that recently passed the House of Commons. And, you know, it seems to me, at least in broad strokes, that this bill is bearing at least some resemblance to the previous scheme that you reported on, this EU-Libya-Rwanda deal that brought you to Rwanda in the first place to report on refugee and migration issues. Can you just take us back and explain what is or was that deal between Libya, the EU, and Rwanda, and how did it work, and what was the kind of plight of refugees in that situation?
I mean, just to underline, like, what you're saying, that there seem to be some similarities. The British government politicians, you know, the Home Office, they have referenced this deal when they're arguing for what they're trying to do. And obviously, this isn't just about me. I'm not like, you know, the fact that I got denied, it seems like part of a much broader issue that there will just not be proper scrutiny of the consequences of this deal. And I probably am the journalist who has done the most reporting extensively on this EU-backed other deal that they keep referencing. And my book, it won the Orwell Prize, the top political prize in the UK, and has a chapter again specifically on Rwanda and treatment of refugees there. So, like, it does actually seem very significant, the fact that I was banned right before the UK government passed a law saying, you know, Rwanda is safe, at least apparently banned.
Well, that's why I wanted to have you on. You know, I've read your book. We've done a whole episode on your book. But the one reason I wanted to have you back on was the curious timing of your rejection from Rwanda and, you know, what it says about a lot of things about press freedom in Rwanda, but about this UK-Rwanda refugee deal as well.
So, yeah, this EU-backed UNHCR-supported deal was basically that a lot of refugees, asylum seekers, get trapped in Libya, particularly since 2017, when the EU started supporting interceptions of people at sea, people who were trying to reach Europe. And so what was happening and is happening is that many people who have fled wars, dictatorships, you know, who would have a right to international protection if they could get onto territory where they could claim that right, were getting trapped in detention centers because when the EU-supported Libyan Coast Guard intercept them at sea, they often lock them up indefinitely in these kind of militia-run detention centers. And so you had people who were spending years locked up in those centers and, you know, no legal route to safety. They can't go home because they'll be persecuted or, you know, their lives will be in danger. And there were calls to have at least some kind of like legal resettlement scheme that would allow them to reach safety. And so initially people were taken because you can't do a proper kind of asylum process, like all of the interviews and everything in Libya when people are locked up in detention centers run by militias in the middle of a war zone. The argument was that you need to take them to another place where they can undergo the kind of full asylum process and then be resettled to a safe country. And so initially that was Niger, and then Niger ran out of space effectively. And so then Rwanda came in and said that they would do it. And people started being moved there in 2019. That was when I went out there, because I actually was in touch with a lot of the people who were moved already when they were in Libya. They were then brought to Rwanda and spent generally months there before they were moved on to other countries.
And what was their experience in Rwanda? I mean, was it safe for them to have their applications processed?
What people need to understand about the idea of safety, it's like there are different types of risks always in every context. And what Rwanda is a police state, you know, it's a dictatorship. And so there are certain fears that come with being in that type of environment. So it might not be that there's crime on the streets, but it might be that you're very frightened that anything you say could be used against you at some particular time. There were even people who refused to go because they were so frightened about it. But others who were moved there, they generally hoped or understood that it was going to be temporary and that they were going to be moved on to other places. So it was different to the UK deal. And it continues, but it's different to the UK deal in that no one wanted to stay there. I remember when I went out the first time, it was November 2019, And there was a lot of fear, you know, fear of like there might be informers. I was only given media accreditation because I was actually told by officials that they believed that I would write good things about them. I still wasn't given access to the camps, but obviously I had the contacts anyway, so we met elsewhere. But they were worried even about being seen with me and being reported. You know, there's a belief that there are informers everywhere in Rwanda, that they couldn't say bad things. That was generally the fear. And I think, again, you know, when you have refugees or asylum seekers, a lot of them are actually fleeing oppression and repression and persecution. They're fleeing like environments where they feel that that's the risk, that you don't have freedom of speech, for example. And to put people back again in a context like that, it can be very, very difficult for them.
So, you know, to me, I look at this UK Rwanda scheme, and it seems to fit part of like a broader pattern that we're seeing over the last several years, in which wealthier countries seek to kind of outsource the processing of asylum claims. Like in the US, we had for a while this Remain in Mexico policy, where potential would-be applicants would have to stay in Mexico before they could claim asylum in the US. The Australians had, you know, for a long time, this policy of keeping people on these like barely inhabited Pacific islands where they would ostensibly support their claims. When you look at this new UK Rwanda deal, like how do you understand it in the broader picture of how the world approaches migration and refugee issues today?
It seems that cruel policies are happening incrementally, and they get slightly crueler every time. And wealthy, privileged countries learn from each other how to bring in those policies and potentially push the button a little bit more every time. Like, my reporting has mostly focused on the EU and what the EU is doing, particularly in the Central Mediterranean, which again is similar. You're pushing people back to a place where they don't have rights. They can't speak out. Their voices will be silenced. We won't actually know what happens to them. And at the same time, spending huge amounts of money in ways that I've demonstrated through my reporting prop up dictatorships or militias or systems that oppress people further. And it's interesting to contrast that with like some of the poorer countries. I was in South Sudan last month, standing on the border with Sudan, and 1,000 people roughly were crossing the border every day. They weren't even checking documents. One of the ministers told me they have an open door policy, that they understand people fleeing war need somewhere to go. And that was kind of astounding for me. You know, a lot of this gets framed as a migration crisis from the perspective of the wealthy country that is having people arrive in it. But actually, the scale of crises generally in the world right now are so huge. And when we actually look at the countries that are suffering them, for example, Sudan, where the war has lasted now more than a year, it's been called the biggest displacement crisis in the world, more than 10 million people displaced. The latest I saw was 1.9 million that have left the country and crossed into other countries. And, you know, that scale of suffering is really, it's hard to understand, but it's also like we need to recognize that when that amount of suffering exists, like the ripples are going to touch everywhere in the world. And one other thing that's important, I think, to say about the Sudan war specifically is that the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces paramilitary group, one of the bodies that has gone to war, was actually said to have been emboldened by EU anti-migration funding, because they were charged with guarding the border after the EU started putting pressure on Sudan to limit the number of people who were heading towards Europe.
So getting back to Rwanda, you know, at least to me, one of the absurdities about this UK bill is, you know, the premise again that Rwanda is safe. And yes, it is like safe from street crime. It is a very clean and orderly place if you've ever been there. It's kind of disturbingly so. And it's that way because it is this police state. There is no press freedom. Journalists have been detained and killed. Opposition leaders have been detained and killed. And the cynicism of this UK bill is just embedded in the fact that Rwanda is just in an unfree and unsafe place.
Again, it's just that seems so clear to me that, again, this is another example of sending people to a place where we actually can't properly monitor the consequences of what happens to them. Like, what happens to them is going to be filtered through, you know, communications officials or PR agencies. And we know that the Rwandan government works with Western PR agencies and has traditionally done that. And it's another example of people's voices being silenced.
Your point about the fact that there really is no credible mechanism of monitoring the impact of these deportations because there is no sort of independent press freedom, I think, is probably part of the reason why the UK, you know, opted to partner with Rwanda in this instance.
Yeah, I mean, officially, I guess that's not something they've said, but potentially that's also why Rwanda opted to partner with the UK, because Rwanda has been accused of using these types of deals to kind of launder its image internationally so that other human rights abuses are overlooked, both in Rwanda and also in the Congo.
Sally, thank you so much for your time and for your amazing reporting as always.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to Global Dispatches. The show is produced by me, Mark Leon Goldberg. It is edited and mixed by Levi Sharp. If you are listening on Apple Podcasts, make sure to follow the show and enable automatic downloads to get new episodes as soon as they're released. On Spotify, tap the bell icon to get a notification when we publish new episodes. And of course, please visit globaldispatches.org to get on our free mailing list, get in touch with me, and access our full archive. Thank you.